Blog Talk Radio.
Where is my promo?
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everybody, from the frigid world of Westchester and everywhere else where it's 3 degrees below zero or more. But we're going to have some fun because we are live and MJ Network is here, and I am your host, Fran Lewis, and I am excited because I have the author of The Company Files, the good man here, Gabriel Vachon. So let me give you a little taste of his book because you're going to want to read this. This is really good. Vienna after the Second World War changed in many ways, and the war criminals that tortured, mutilated, and cremated innocent people walked the earth. Some were found guilty and put to death, while others were never arrested, and they lurked in the depths of deception. Jack Marshall and Walker served during the war and are now working for the company. With the help of analyst Leslie, who works undercover and helped to gain intelligence from infiltrating Hitler's inner circle, recruit former Nazis with information that can help our country stay ahead and afloat in the atomic race. But there is much more to this espionage and subterfuge as someone out there finds these men related to Hitler and takes them down one by one. That is the first paragraph of my review. And good morning, and how are you? And we are ready.
Oh, good morning, Fran. Thank you for having me. This is Gabriel, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, could you give everyone, why did you decide to choose Vienna 1948 as the time period for this novel?
Okay. Well, I was intrigued by the fact that when I was doing some research and I thought a lot of people were not aware that, you know, in the early days of the CIA, that which was the Office of Strategic Services at that time, the first operations occurred in Vienna. And as you explained previously, in this novel, we have characters that are trying to determine what former Nazis knew about the Soviet atomic program. And one of the things I discovered is that Vienna was a divided city at the end of the war. There was, you know, the French had one side of the city, the Russians had another, the Americans and the British had the other. So it was a real kind of Wild West environment. And I think, you know, contrary to what we think about the CIA today and espionage and thrillers and political intrigue, in the early days, I don't think anybody knew what they were doing. So I thought that was, you know, very interesting material to work with. And also, too, you know, I think what we know of Vienna, maybe we know through movies like The Third Man, Graham Greene, Carol Reed. And I think it was a lot more complex than that. And I thought it was something to explore. And that's why I ended up writing this novel.
Well, it was very interesting. I'll tell you that. So from the title of the book, that there's going to be a lot more sequels to this.
Yes. So the company is basically a euphemism for the CIA. As I said, you know, in 1947, 1948, it was the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. It became the CIA later by presidential directive. But as I said, you know, here we were at the America, United States, at the end of the World War, and we were structurally intact, and we had certain advantages. So the OSS, you know, basically was still in Europe. Everything was coming over eventually to the U.S., but nobody knew what they wanted, what the direction of the company would be. Here in the U.S., the FBI, you know, took care of or investigated criminal activity. The CIA really had no mission statement, if you will. So in this first novel, I try to explore those early days, and the title, The Good Man, I was trying to play with the idea of ambiguity of, you know, here we are, who is the, you know, you have these cast of characters, who is the good man and what defines a good person? Because we're now entering a sphere of activity that's morally ambiguous. We're now dealing and interviewing Nazis who were our enemies, trying to find out something, you know, technical against the Soviets or the Russians who were our allies in World War II. So I hope that when readers read the novel that they ask themselves, you know, what people's motivations are.
Well, if you read my review, you'll find out. You know what made it really easy? It's easy for me. The number one, I've read so many books I have lost count. And you put a character chart, so it helped me to know who is who and who was in charge of whatever and who everybody was, which is great. The other great part was there weren't 10,000 characters, which really would have makes life difficult. When you have a character list of about 50 characters and go like, oh, my God, I have to remember all of those. So this made it easy. And I like Jack Marshall. I like Walker. I like Whitaker, and that I won't give away the rest of it. So what is an insurance company? What do they do exactly? Because that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Okay, so for readers listening, I spell out assurance, A-S-S-U-R-A-N-C-E. Mm-hmm. It's basically the European version or spelling of insurance. So in the novel, Jack Marshall has an office in Vienna, and his front, you know, it looks like a regular office, but he's basically trying to convince people that he is an insurance business. But essentially, it's a front for the CIA and just a different spelling for insurance.
Mm-hmm. So who are the major players in this particular one? We have Jack Marshall and the company. He's station chief in Vienna. And his role is to make sure that they learn about the Nazis that they're found in deciding how to deal with war criminals. And Leslie and several others. But how do they do that? How do they go around to propose to do this? Because this is dangerous to them also.
Right. So let's step back for a second. So you have Jack Marshall, which, as you said, is the station chief. So he's the boss of the office. He has people working with him. So he has Walker, who is an associate of his, basically an agent. And Walker is somebody that Jack knew and from the Army. They served together in the Army. Later on, you will meet Leslie, who is a secretary in the office. She also has her own background in intelligence. And I hope that readers will see that, you know, women have played a vital role in the early days of intelligence. And unfortunately, when the war ended, a lot of these women who had incredible skill sets were basically asked to be secretaries or to go home and get married and have a family. Another character you'll sort of hear about is Whitaker, who is also somebody that Jack and Walker served with. He's kind of the strong arm. He's the guy that, you know, goes out in the field and tries to find out what's going on. And he's a little bit of a troublemaker. You'll also meet Sheldon, a character who we find out is a survivor of the concentration camps. And when you're reading the story, you'll realize that Vienna became a way station for a lot of refugees after World War II. Russians, displaced people from Eastern Europe. So Sheldon's, you know, again, you know, the question is he a good man? Here he's somebody who they suspect might be offing the very people that they want to interview. So they understand why he's doing that, but they need to ask him to stop because they have their own objective and they want to interview these people. And basically, Walker and Whitaker go out through Vienna and they look for Nazis. I mean, at this point, Nazis aren't wearing their uniforms anymore. And a lot of them are trying to hide their past through aliases.
No, I understand. My grandmother was in a Polish sterilization camp.
I try to weave in some of the history. So the state of Israel was founded in 1948, but the Jewish or the Israel question was really a political football at that time. There were a lot of people that were for it and against it. For example, General George Marshall, from whom we get the Marshall Plan, was actually against the formation of the state of Israel because he felt that if we backed that, we would be committed to being in the Middle East forever and ever. So you have these refugees that were basically stateless, and nobody wanted to take them, and not just Jewish, but a lot of other people. With Sheldon, you find out that he is a survivor of Auschwitz. You also find out that he participated in a rebellion at Auschwitz, which actually happened. Another slice of history that I don't think a lot of people know about. Unfortunately, it did not end well.
It's scary, I know. And when she told me what she went through, I couldn't believe it. There's so many things that nobody really knew that they endured. So why would learning this and getting this intel help the U.S. in the atomic race? How did that come into play in the novel, too?
Well, that's where there's a lot of moral ambiguity. So when I was doing the research for this, there were files that were declassified by the CIA, and one of the operations was called Operation Paperclip. So... In essence, what that was interviewing Nazi scientists, and a lot of them, for better or for worse, a lot of them were brought over to the United States and had their names changed. They were relocated. And we owe a lot of our rocket technology and the foundation of NASA to certain key Nazi scientists. And it's, sad and also questionable how we overlooked some of the things that they did during the war. And I also want to emphasize the reason why the CIA was interested in interviewing Nazis is because they couldn't get access to any of the files and scientific papers that the Nazis had, because when the Soviets swept in westward towards Berlin, the Soviet army, the Red Army, actually liberated a lot of the concentration camps. They also knew that the Nazis were very meticulous about paperwork and documented everything. It's one of the reasons why we know so much about the Holocaust is because they kept paperwork, the numbers of prisoners and stuff like that, although they were careful never to use incriminating words about extermination. So Soviets basically swept in, took all those scientific papers, put them on a train, sent them back to Moscow. So American intelligence knew about it, but they had no paperwork. So they had to basically go to their former enemy and talk to them.
This was so interesting to learn more about it. Why would Sheldon work with Jack and his team, and who is the general that helps him? That was very interesting, especially the Constantine coin. I felt that really, very good. That was really interesting. So what was special about this sixth one, and why did he help him?
Okay, so step back for a second with Sheldon. So as I mentioned, Sheldon's a former concentration camp survivor. I don't think necessarily that he outwardly wanted to work with Jack. I think he realized that Jack and Walker were in the deep end of the pond, and they're kind of very wary with each other because Jack and Walker aren't 100% sure that Sheldon's behind it. But Sheldon also, he needs help too. He befriends a young girl, Tanya, and now he has to think about somebody else other than himself. Mm-hmm. When Jack starts gathering intelligence and information about players in Vienna, he comes across by way of Sheldon, a former Soviet general, which I simply call the general. And I think one of the things that I wanted to get across was that not every Soviet soldier was a diehard communist. It just turned out by circumstance in history that Stalin ended up being the ruler. There was a lot of infighting. There was a lot of feuds. As we know now, Stalin eliminated a lot of his enemies. And some of them were former military because he felt threatened by them. So the general is also a, I guess you could say, a victim of history also. And he's trying to figure out his place in the world.
Well, Jack is smart, and Walker is pretty smart, and he's close to them. And he seems to be very close to Leslie. He's enthralled by her. And yet, we
yes.
know that there's something that we need to know about her. So how does he get close to her, and what is he? How does he find out that maybe he better put the red flag up?
Well, I think...
That's the best way I could put it.
Walker and Leslie are... you know, in many ways, two ships passing in the night. One of the things that you mentioned earlier that you've read a lot of books in this genre, and, you know, it's they often tend to be very dark and, you know, sometimes violent or, you know, shadowy, for lack of better words. And with Walker, I wanted to present somebody who was somebody who was just simply didn't know what to do with his life. And he's not exactly the most confident person. And here he is being asked to work for the company by Jack, and Jack believes in him. Leslie, I believe, also helps Walker with his lack of confidence. And he's intrigued by her because she's extremely competent. She's underutilized. I wouldn't say he's scared of her, but he definitely respects her. And they're kind of, you know, I sort of an insinuation of, you know, romantic interest, too.
Well, we have something that's very interesting to people because we all have computers and we all have ways of saving information. But when people were younger,
yes.
they didn't have that. This was so fascinating because I remember having to type a term paper when I took my second master's, and I remember having to not be allowed to use a computer with typewriter. So things get more tense when typewriter ribbons are stolen or get messed up or smushed or whatever. So what was on them and how would they protect them? How come somebody was able to steal the typewriter ribbon? This is fascinating because I say, oh, my God, typewriter ribbons. Who knows about that?
So let me step back for readers. So in the early days, like Fran was saying, we obviously didn't have computers. I mean, this was still the days of where people did telegrams and, you know, sent letters and, you know, hiding letters on their person. One of the things I had learned from a friend of mine who was a Marine guard at an embassy was that the typewriters, you know, obviously, you know, they were used to type out and create all this communication. Often later put on telex and all that. But my point is at night, the Marine guards would go around the office and take the ribbons out of the typewriter because if somebody broke into the office and stole the typewriter ribbons, they actually can spool out the ribbons and see what was typed. So what they would do is rather, you know, because they didn't want anybody stealing them, they would lock them up in the safe. And there is a plot point in The Good Man where typewriter ribbons go missing. And that's one of the mysteries as to who stole them. So it's,
I know.
It's interesting,
that was,
you know.
That's like scary. That was scary.
Well, people think of, you know, James Bond and high tech and all that. But that's another thing, you know, in the early days of intelligence and spycraft, it really was low tech. The consequences were tremendous, but the technology, you know, here we are, typewriter ribbons, and, you know, you mentioned doing a term paper, you know, all through high school, I had to type out all my papers, so, you know, it wasn't like we had spell check, and you can go backwards and, you know, look at a word, consult this thesaurus inside of Microsoft Word. And you had to, I remember when I was typing, I was always trying to make sure I had the margins right. So it's different technology.
I had to type these term papers on index cards on both sides. And there was
index
no way
cards.
That you could put a carbon behind it. Yeah, it was like this reading professor in college said you had to type them on index cards, big ones. I was like, oh my God.
Right.
And yeah, and single spaced.
Well,
so,
to give you a quick example of the technology, if you go back, look at the TV show Adam 12, in the opening scene, you have the operators, you know, they're going to radio out to the patrolmen out in the field. But watch the opening scene, and you see these little index cards on a, it's like a little belt that go flying by, and the operator would pick them up. So, you know, that's the late 60s.
Well,
so
this,
I, you know,
this
my
is later.
Story isn't. Yes,
this is
that's
later,
later.
But I can't believe that I actually did it. And
yes.
Yeah, it was hard. And then he made us do more, and he said you could only type on, you know, both sides. And then when he gave me my grade, he said, in your case, you can use as many as you want because you're smart. It's like, okay. Yeah, and the articles were 20 pages long because he picked them for me after a while. I said, that's not fair. So sometimes you don't know. So who is Peggy? And why does Walker, those are interesting, flash back to her. And what was their relationship?
So Peggy,
and how come it didn't work out, poor thing?
Right. So Peggy is a high school sweetheart of Walker. And I think in many ways, as I said earlier, he's not very confident, both as a new field agent. He's also not very confident, you know, as a man around women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had his heart broken. I guess in many ways, he still carries a torch for Peggy. And Leslie is the exact opposite of Peggy. And that's, you know, something else that where Walker has to step up and gain his confidence. So Peggy's somebody who he knew from his past life, represented, you know, the world that he knew before the war. In the novel, I do show what Walker went through in the war. Another fact that, you know, people lose sight of is the average age for a man in World War II in combat, if they saw combat, was around 25 to 27. You know, these are not, you know, 17, 18, 19-year-old young men. So here we have Walker, who's in his late 20s, early 30s, doing a new line of work. But there's a certain innocence to him. And I think that's something of a bygone era. I guess you could argue that we don't see today.
So we've got Whitaker, and what happens when he disappears? And what about him that they learn for disappearing? Why does he disappear, and how does he have to do with the coin?
Okay, so two things here. So I mentioned earlier that Whitaker had served in the Army with Jack and Walker. As I said, he's a little bit of a loose cannon. Kind of does things in an unorthodox way. So one of the subplots in the novel is he disappears. So Jack now has to figure out what happened to him and where did he go and why did he disappear. The coin is a symbol of trust. The coin is something that Sheldon knew about, that the general knew about, and Jack eventually learns about. But we now start seeing that there's artifacts running through Vienna, valuable things. And I don't necessarily want to, you know, let loose a spoiler, but Whitaker was known for, you know, trying to make money on the side.
So we've got, he gets involved with the wrong people in the wrong places, doesn't he? So when you read the book, and as I'm reading it, I'm going like, not everybody is who they seem. And one of the characters that seems to have a very strong hold over by everybody is Meeks. So what do you want to tell us about him? I didn't like this guy at all. Sorry. She's not one of my
favorite
people.
Okay, so Meeks is somebody sent over from the U.S. He is somebody that has political connections. So at this time, you know, as I said, you know, the CIA was not actually formed. The OSS was considered an artifact of World War II, a valuable one, and people wanted to leverage what was gained by using it, but they didn't know what to do with it. So Meeks is somebody that's sent over by politicians in the U.S. to say, you know, go and look at this, see if it's a worthwhile thing, and if it is, you know, we will appropriate money for it. So he's basically somebody, I wouldn't say a lobbyist, but somebody who is going to report back to senators and Congress to, you know, either A, fund the CIA or OSS or can it. And he is a very opinionated person and arrogant.
Now we have a situation that was kind of like put John put them in a bad position there, as we realize that the notes are stolen. And how come he insists that, who is Major Davis, and what happens when Meeks demands that he give him the folder with his notes? I mean, I have to go along with what he said, because I wouldn't do it either. I agree with Jack. I would not give it to him if I didn't have to.
Okay. So Major Davis is someone who is in Europe. He is essentially Jack's superior, but he gives Jack a lot of leeway because he respects Jack. And Major Davis is, you know, somebody that Jack knew and served with. There's a certain amount of respect between them. And now Meeks is basically coming between Jack and Major Davis because he knows Major Davis is the commander. But he wants information and he wants to apply pressure. And Meeks sort of acts like, you know, whatever I ask for, you're going to give it to me no matter what. And as you said, you know, there's a certain amount of distrust and also a power dynamic.
So we've got a very interesting relationship here and character, one that I don't know if you're going to bring back, but I hope you do in a way, Tanya. And she becomes part of Sheldon's life. And I could see where she, you know, had a problem and start, but it'd be interesting to see if you bring her back and if she, you know, turns into something else. How does she become part, and why did he feel it was necessary to protect her? What was her, part of her story anyway?
So Tanya is basically a young girl, 12, 13 years old. She's Russian. She's a refugee. Sheldon finds her in a precarious situation and rescues her. And I think, you know, the relationship between them, I would like to believe that Sheldon sees some of his humanity and former culture in her. And I think, you know, if prior to her, he only had to care about himself in Vienna. Now, by knowing her, he has another reason to live. I mean, he's doing things that are pretty dicey and suicidal, but now he has to somebody else to account for. I do bring her back. The second book, The Naming Game, comes out in May. Tanya is not in that one. Tanya's in the third one. In the third one, I'm editing. So she is a recurring character, as is Leslie. You'll see
definitely
more of Leslie in book two.
Well, you said you're doing, it's coming out in May, you said, right?
Yes, the second book, The Naming Game, is coming out in May.
Okay, are you doing another tour?
Right now, I probably will do another tour. I have arcs in my hands. I'm trying to organize strategy around that. Just what I've tried to do, and want readers to know this, is that at the end of each of my novels, I always put the first chapter of the next one so that they can see or get a taste test. So at the end of The Good Man, you get the first chapter of The Naming Game. I also have it online on my blog, Gabriel's Wharf, which is a WordPress blog. The second book is now in the U.S. It's 1951, and the story takes place in Los Angeles. And there's a murdered scriptwriter. Jack is called in to investigate it. Because something's fishy about it. It's not just a typical murder. And the upshot is he sends Walker into the Hollywood studios to be a writer. And
I have it in front
a lot
of
intrigue.
I have it right here. There is. That's probably why I asked you if there's going to be more. Because it's different. You know what I really like is when you have a character that's in a series, that you don't do the same thing with the person. That the person grows and there's something different. Otherwise, it makes it hard for this girl to review the book all the time. And I like when something's changing. So if you send it to me, I will do. I will read it. I promise you.
Okay. Well, one of the things I do as a writer is I try to write 3 to 5 books. Most often they're drafts, and then I really fine-tune them. But when I go and do my editing, I try to look not only at the story arc in each novel, but I look at the character arc throughout the series. Because as you said, I want people to see growth in each one of the characters. Yeah. One of the things I find fascinating as a writer is when I have a series and, I have 3 or 4 principal characters, I like asking people, okay, you read, 2 or 3 books. I have another series where I have 5 books, but that's all set in Italy and the U.S., the Roma series. I ask readers, what character did you like? And I'm always fascinated with their answers because, you create somebody that you as a writer like and favor, and then somebody gives you somebody else. They're like, oh, no, I really like this person. And you're like, oh, okay, wow, that's interesting. It's a lot of fun.
I like Sheldon, too. I just thought I'd throw that in also. I do. So, we have Tanya, and her personality is one way when you meet her. And then she sort of gets a little oochie-coochie in the middle. So, she doesn't appear to be so innocent, and that made sense. How did you decide to create that? Because that didn't make sense. Because after a while, she's learning how to become not such a pretty, prim and proper little girl.
Right. So when you read a lot of spy fiction or noir, you have this convention of a femme fatale, a woman who is very sexy, very alluring, very dangerous. She brings men to ruin. And she has her own dysfunctions. Tanya is a young girl, but she's also somebody that's been traumatized by war, by other things. And I want to convey to people that, childhood is not always innocent. And people, when they're put to extremes, have to resort to what they have on hand. And she is somebody who is very aware that she's attractive. She's very aware that men are interested in her. And she maybe awkwardly, sometimes expertly, learns how to manipulate people. And part of it, at a superficial level, that's a survival mechanism. But the other part of it is it's a compensation for the trauma she's been through. So, as you said, one moment, she's a child. And the next moment, she's like, okay, we see a side of her that's very alluring, but also maybe age inappropriate.
If you watch programs today, you can see that wouldn't be such a surprise, unfortunately.
Right. But I think you hear people today. They make these comments like, things were innocent. Life was better back in the old days, and I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, it was the same no matter what, unfortunately.
Right.
So, Marshall said he could help Sheldon, get a visa for Tanya, but it wouldn't cost him money. What would it cost him? And would he do something like that?
Well, you have to I leave that to the reader to try to think about it. I mean, it's yes, you're right. He's looking to get her a visa, which is, you know, it's that little, you know, carrot on the stick, because, you know, Jack wants allies. And I think Jack is smart enough to think and realize that Sheldon is better as a friend than as an enemy.
Yeah.
So,
without a doubt, before I forget, and I don't want to forget, I just found out, you know, sometimes when I do a radio show, I tell the author, like way before, I just found out tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, I'm being interviewed on KRC 550 AM by the Brian Thomas Show for my book, A Daughter's Promise, My Mother Who Had Alzheimer's. So that I'm kind of like, okay, I have no idea what they're going to ask me, none at all. On Thursday, we have Chasing the Rabbit with Derek Vogue. And on the 28th, we have David Rosenfeld, Deck the Hound. And on the 29th, we have Jean DeRocha, A Dark Paradise. And that's just the rest of January. February is going to really be hot. So what happens when Whitaker is found, and how did you create that dramatic scene? And that was a tissue scene, trust me. Seriously.
I don't know. I just wrote it because that was what was in my head. sometimes you just, when you get into the story and you're writing it, things just happen, and you know, you start down one road and you go down another. I have a couple of I guess action scenes in the novel, and you know, I try to spend a lot of time to make that vivid and convincing.
So what happens when who is Leslie? Really, we know that she's not who she says she is, and then Walker has to face her at work. How do you deal with someone when you know that you're not really sure if you should trust them? That makes it kind of hard. How do you deal with somebody like that at work? And does she ever realize that he's not seen, he sees right
there?
Well,
I mean, I think, you know, I'm asking people the same question, you know.
Yeah.
That can you truly ever really know somebody? I mean, you know, you could be married to somebody and not know everything about them. So everybody carries their own secret. I don't, you know, the question is whether or not they deliberately hide it or not. Leslie obviously obscures her past, and she has motivations to do that. But again, you know, this is a novel where nobody is what they seem. And yet somehow they have to learn to work with each other. And it's, I think the difficulty in the writing is conveying that sense of trust when you shouldn't, because it's counterintuitive, but yet you have to do something to make it work.
Well, you did. So what does what the Nazis wanted have to do with science and research? That was really interesting.
Well, the research, you know, I did involve, you know, reading, you know, obviously a lot about World War II, reading about, you know, Eastern Europe, Vienna, reading people who had lived through the time period and, you know, wrote memoirs. I looked at a lot of pictures. You know, I try to let my imagination go in a different direction by looking at a picture and trying to describe it or imagining what it'd be like in that scene. You know, Vienna is known for cafes. You know, it's one of the coffee capitals of Europe. Most of 19th century literature, you know, people like Freud and music composers sat in these cafes. So I was wondering what it would be like to be in that kind of environment, and yet know, you know, everything around you has been bombed and needs to be rebuilt. So there was the historical research, and then in terms of Operation Paperclip, I started, you know, finding other books where historians and people that were like political analysts, you know, went through the files and talked about it. Operation Paperclip lasted up to about 1990. So basically, you know, it pretty much ceased as an operation because of the fall of communism. So that's a treasure trove of information. Some of it can be a little unsettling.
I actually, when I read books like this, look up the information too. So I did. I did look up Operation Paperclip and a whole bunch of other things. I did because I wanted to make sure that I understood what the book is about, which I did. So another thing that I found fascinating is we have We have Whittaker, Walker, Marshall disposed of. But what I really love is Walker's gun. How did he give it a name, and why was this gun his trademark, and how did you create that? I thought that was really great.
Okay. So going back, you know, I mentioned earlier that Walker had a high school sweetheart, Peggy, and the joke was, you know, they had, you know, these dates, and they went out, and they went to a movie, and I described what Peggy looks like, and I also described that on a date that they had gone out with, that Walker kind of became infatuated with the actress Betty Grable, and Peggy teases him about it, and she gives him a picture of Betty Grable. And Betty Grable, as you know, was famous through World War II for fundraising and for being a pinup model. So he names his gun after Betty Grable. It becomes his connection to Peggy in the past, but also to his immediate connection to World War II and his service. So I thought, you know, in a way, making the gun a character would be fun.
Well, he seemed lost without it, though. I mean, when it was missing and whatever, he seemed like he needed to really have it. It was like almost it identified him, that particular thing.
Well,
what happened?
You don't ever want to be separated from your service piece.
It's sort of like part of him that he can't. Yeah, I guess maybe. And the fact that he named it is even better.
Right.
Especially after somebody that's great like Betty Grable. So what happens that let readers know that there are other forces out there, and I still don't like Meeks? So what happens that lets us know that there's other things that are going to happen, but we're not going to say what and who's behind them?
Right. With this particular series, I want to show readers not everything ends with a bow tie, you know. I mean, you certainly get the mission accomplished, but, you know, the ongoing questions, I think, are the relationships, you know, what's going to happen to these people. And I'm hoping that readers care about these characters, you know, both for their well-being and, you know, their emotional lives. You know, with Walker, as I said, you know, back in World War II, they didn't have a name for PTSD. They had shell shock, battle fatigue. I mean, he is somebody that had that, but I also, in writing it, didn't want to get into cliches. I mean, I tried to make it very human, you know, what he's going through. And I think one of the key things there is he can't explain to people what he went through and what he felt, what he's feeling. And there's also a sense to his character that he knows life has changed for him. He's really the alien in the room, and now he's trying to find his way in the world.
Now I'm looking at the book in front of me, because I don't give anybody the books until I'm done interviewing the person or reviewing it. Then I have to tell you, there are quite a few people that have asked me for this. They're going to have to fight in numbers.
Thank you.
That's what happens when a friend has a lot of books to review. I may not give it to them. They may have to just go out and buy it. Too bad. So how did you decide on the cover of this book? It's very interesting. Why did you decide just to go with a cover like that? That was really, you know, I love covers, and they sort of like tell what the book is about, but this is sort of very different.
Sure.
How did you determine the cover on this one?
Well, I wanted to, because I knew I was creating a series, I wanted to create I don't want to say static, but I wanted to have a recurring image mm-hmm. on the cover that stays throughout mm-hmm. the series, obviously with the title changing. So for mm-hmm. readers listening, what you see on the cover, and you could find it online too, is you're looking at essentially a white background, which could be like a piece of paper, and you're looking down mm-hmm. and you see a typewriter ribbon, and the top part is black and the bottom part is red. The letters for the titles and all that are red. So everything that the CIA did, everything was typed up. And because typewriter ribbon is part of the plot in the story, I wanted to include mm-hmm. the typewriter ribbon on the cover. The color scheme I picked was, I mean, typewriter ribbons came in those colors, you know, the black on top, the red mm-hmm. on bottom, was mm-hmm. you had the main, you know, your primal colors, black and white, good and evil, but you also have red. And red mm-hmm. throughout the story has to do with communism, because that's what the CIA was originally founded and predicated on, was to prevent the spread of communism in the U.S. and abroad. So it's intended as a very stark image. So the first book is The Good Man. The second book is The Naming Game. The third one is titled The Diminished Fifth. There's a reason for that. But so I just wanted to have a compelling image that tried to draw people in, you know, with simple color scheme. A lot of covers I see today use blues and blacks and dark shades and all that. And I thought having something stand out that was stark would be the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was difficult in typing in a typewriter with the ribbons, yes, and having to replace them and having to put on gloves so that you don't get the ink all over your fingers is if you make a mistake.
Yep.
And then, you know, they didn't
right.
have any way to make a mistake. And they had paper. My mother told me that you could erase it, erasable paper, and then you had to pray that you didn't erase too much. And then you couldn't really put a carbon behind it. So it made it kind of hard. So
right.
the fact that they invented, you know, word processors helped, but computers, thank God. So let's move ahead just a little bit. So when the book is ended, why did you include what happens 2 years later? And with Jack and his new family, how did you decide to incorporate that? We have about 10 minutes.
All right. So basically the story started in 1948 in Vienna. I jump ahead to 1950. The jump ahead had to do with coming back to the United States, showing Jack with his family, and now realizing you know, we do the OSS is now the CIA. It is the company. So we have a scene that also ties in as to what happens to Sheldon. And we sort of have a reunion of sorts, and some secrets are revealed maybe. So I jumped ahead because I wanted to have the story now come to the U.S. and the story. The rest of the novels will occur in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So how does Sheldon fit into the final picture? And that's what I was wondering when I read the first chapter of the next book, that you decided a new location. How come this time? What different locations? Because a lot of books, you know, it's hard to follow, but not this one. You know, they go like in 20 different locations, and I'm going like, wait a minute, I need one of my graphic organizers from when I was teaching, you know, reading. And,
Sure.
So how come you moved it to another location, and at least you didn't make it 75 of them? How many locations are going to be in the next book?
The next book, The Naming Game, will be centered primarily in Los Angeles. So when Jack and company come back to the U.S., Jack lives with his family in D.C. The end of The Good Man shows him visiting Walker in California. Walker lives in Malibu. And Malibu in 1950 was very, very interesting and very different, basically an artist colony. So the next book, it starts in L.A. because the premise to the novel is there's a script writer that's been found murdered, and Jack gets a call from Chief Will Parker, the head of LAPD, basically saying, I need your help. And because Walker's on the West Coast, Jack basically calls on Walker to, you know, investigate, because he lives in D.C. and has to stay in D.C. So there's a little bit of, you know, transcontinental communication there. But most everything that happens, for the most part, happens in Los Angeles. And it's, a very interesting time period with the Red Scare, McCarthy, and what the Hollywood studios were doing to writers that were blacklisted.
Mm. But you're not going to bring anything back. A lot of authors, when they have a series, are you going to bring any information back from the first book, or are you just going to start off with the second?
I do thread in a little bit of background information in the second book, but
yeah,
I still intend the second book to be a standalone, so that if you hadn't read the first one, you're not at the mercy of, you know, being left out of information. I think if you read both, obviously you have a richer experience. So I don't do flashbacks or anything like that. I give information that is done in a way where you kind of realize there's more to the characters, that there's more history between them. So in the second book,
That would make sense.
So in the second book, you'll see Jack, you'll see Leslie, you'll see Walker, and you'll see Sheldon.
And you give people a little bit of information. So you're going to bring all those back. So we learn more about the general in the last chapter. And why was he really someone? Even Russians considered him a friend before we close. We have that and one more question after.
What I tried to do with the general is to show that, you know, not everybody at the end of the war believed in Stalin. And I do think, you know, people were very painfully aware that we were in a new age, and with nuclear weapons, you know, that changed warfare. And, you know, the general was somebody who was in conventional warfare. And I think he was somebody that looked at the fact that, you know, if anybody uses these weapon, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, we all lose. So, you know, he also, in Soviet politics, was not a firm believer in Stalin. But then again, Stalin got rid of everybody else, so.
Yeah, I know. And it's kind of hard to deal with the fact that some of these people actually got away. So we know what's next for the company. And where can we learn more about your other series, the Roma series, and your other work?
Yes.
And where can everybody connect with you?
Okay, so the Roma series has 5 books. It's about a woman who's a forensic accountant that goes on the lam. She had worked for a covert U.S. agency. Those books are available on Amazon. There's reviews on Amazon. There's reviews on Goodreads. Mm-hmm. Obviously, on Amazon, you can look inside, you know, sample a reading to see if it's something you like. That series is different in the sense that I deal with a lot of food, Italian culture. There's a little bit, it's a little bit lighter than The Good Man. You know, it's there's humor there. You have 5 main characters, and each book, you know, more or less turns the spotlight on a different character, so you can learn more about them and have variety. But the main character is a woman named Bianca.
That sounds interesting.
So,
and what websites do you have? What is your website, and how can people learn more about your work?
Sure. So I have one. I have a blog, Gabriel's Wharf. It's all one word. It's gabrielswharf.wordpress.com. Now, I also have a website where I have some excerpts, 2 of my works, and also a lot of my other publications. Mm-hmm. And that's my first and last name, GabrielValjean.com. And people can go there and learn a little bit about me. If people attend conferences, I go to BoucherCon. Mm-hmm. I go to Malice Domestic and Crime Bake, which is here in New England. I live in Boston. And if you see me, say hello. usually at conferences, people have their little name tags on, so don't be shy.
Are you going to be at the Philofest? Do you ever go to that, the one in the Grand Hyatt? Because I'm going to be there this year. I get invited.
Yeah, I found out about it last year at BadgerCon. Mm-hmm. I believe it's in New York, so I'm
yes,
it
is.
I am
it's
looking
at the Grand
at
Hyatt.
It.
It's okay. July 8th to July
July, okay.
14th. July 8th. Yeah, I'm going to be there from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday because they invite me because I do all the reviews for just about everybody that's there. So one of the nice things about Kimberly Howe and John Land and all and Dick and everybody is that they invite me to the Grand Hyatt to come to see the to meet the authors, to get more interviews, and just to get to know everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's really great because I love doing what I'm doing. And I hope you come. That would be really great. I think Reggie Belsky would really be happy if you came.
Another one I'm looking at and see whether or not I commit to is Murder and Mayhem in Chicago. That's in March. So I'm looking at that. But that's a one-day conference and several writers I know. Several writers I know attend that. BoucherCon seems to take – everybody goes to that. I've met some great people there. Bruce Coffin, Dick Belsky, Eric Beatner. The list just goes on. I mean, Danny Gardner, and then, you know, obviously several big names, you know, Megan Abbott, Lee Child. It's a lot of fun. BouchCon, you know, sometimes can feel a little bit overwhelming. But it is a lot of fun, and the panels are excellent. Readers get a chance to see, you know, the writers they admire, get to meet them, get books signed, hear how they think, how they work.
It's great, and I absolutely love when they just hand me the book and say, here, it's yours to review. But I want to thank you so very, very much.
Yes. Thank you.
My nephew's in Boston, too, and he just texted me that he's freezing also. But here it is now. Oh, my God, it's getting warmer. It's from 2 degrees, it went up to 4. Yay.
Oh, wow.
I want to thank you so much. I hope you send me your next book. And if you want to send me anything on the Roma series, let me know. Cheryl, get ready for Silenced Voices. My book is being edited as we speak. And as soon as it's done and it's published, I'm going to do another tour with Partners in Crime because they're the best. Okay, so everybody, have a great day. It's a beautiful day outside. It's cold, but the sun is shining. Have a great day, and bye.
Thank you.